From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, more reaction to the headmaster's resignation at Boston Latin School.
We were tending to hyper-focus these issues of equity, of race, on Boston Latin. And for me, that was short-sighted and that was narrow-minded.
Also, the looming nurses' strike at Brigham and Women's Hospital. We'll hear both sides.
We're not doing it just because we want an extra vacation day. We're doing it because we're trying to make the patients safe.
The hospital has worked very hard to find common ground both on wages and on the health insurance issue.
And Democrats stage a sit-in on the House floor calling for action on gun control.
So today we come to the well of the House to dramatize the need for action. Not next month, not next year, but now, today.
It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And let's start today with the continuing fallout from yesterday's resignation of the headmaster of Boston Latin School. Lynn Mooney Tata stepped down after months of controversy and an ongoing federal inquiry into allegations of racism at the school. In a letter to the school community, Tata said she made the difficult decision in the best interests of Boston Latin students and that, quote, over the 9 years of my tenure as headmaster, we have built the foundation to create a more welcoming and inclusive school environment, there is still more work that needs to be done. Boston Latin is the city's premier exam school, and the debate over its troubles with race and inclusivity have spilled over to questions about similar challenges across the entire Boston Public School District. So a little earlier today, we spoke with City Councilor Andrea Campbell for her take on this. She is an alumna of Boston Latin, and I started by asking her for her reaction to Lynn Mooney Tata's resignation.
I think it's extremely significant. I must say, because of the way in which it happened, it was a surprise not only to me, but for even the three people who work with me who are Boston Latin School alum. One just graduated this year and is interning in my office. So it's definitely sent shock waves and a ripple through, I think, the Latin School community. And this is an institution with an extensive history, so to have it happen in such a manner has been shocking and unsettling.
So do you think that this move to have the headmaster step down was necessary, though, to make some progress in dealing with the core issues that are roiling Boston Latin?
I don't know. I've met when these allegations and when the BLS Black students came forward to talk about some of their horrific experiences and the way in which they were handled or not handled correctly. I met with the headmaster. I met with the dean of discipline, Mr. Flynn, who was the dean of discipline when I was a Latin school student. And I continued to meet with parents and students, and my office helped with some of the allegations that came forward, and we were able to resolve some of those. And at no point at that time did I have parents or students who asked me directly for her to resign. If anything, they thought that we as alum, including electeds, needed to work with her in the administration to think about how we respond to issues of race, issues of oppression, prejudice. So this is a shock, and only the future will tell us if this was the right move. Right now, I'm more concerned about how we as alum support the students, support the administration and BPS in the transition and go forward.
Well, so talk to me more about that. I mean, how would you like that to be handled? Because, I mean, really, the question now, which you were alluding to, is what can the district do? What can the school do in order to support students at Boston Latin, and not only at Boston Latin, but across the district? Because I think what happened, you know, at the city's premier exam school has really reignited the conversation about race across Boston public schools in general.
And that is exactly what it did. And the problem for me from the get-go is that we were tending to hyper-focus these issues of equity, of race, on Boston Latin. And for me, that was short-sighted, and that was, I've said this in the past, narrow-minded. These are issues that are present across the entire city of Boston, not just in this space of education. So we need to talk about these issues in the bigger context of equity. I am a proud graduate of Boston Latin School. I would not be where I am today if it weren't for Latin School. I would not have went to a Princeton University or a UCLA law school but for Latin. But I am acutely aware that others did not have the same experience that I did at Latin, and that there has been a significant decline in the students of color. So this is a conversation that we need to have at a larger level, and we need to ask the question, why do students who live in a certain geographic location, why do certain students who have a certain race or those who are poor don't have access, equitable access to quality education? And it's bigger than Latin School. And I think if we continue to make it about Latin, we'll be back in the same space few years from now, just in the context of another school.
I take your point, and I want to ask you more about the district as a whole in a second, but can you, if you don't mind me asking, this isn't a roundabout way of me asking how old you are, but what years did you go to Boston Latin?
I graduated Latin in 2000.
In 2000. Okay. Can you just describe to me what the environment was like when you were there, since, you know, you graduated in 2000, and it seems like at that point in time there were more students of color.
There were definitely more students of color, and I had a positive experience at Latin because, for me, Latin School was a space in which I could go in and put my head down, focus on my academics, focus on some of the after-school programs I participated in, and, frankly, leave the world behind that I was dealing with, that I was suffering in. So things that were happening at my home, we were poor, my father was someone who was recently incarcerated and dealt with a lot of anger issues. There were things happening in the community. So Latin School was an escape for me. But for those around me, some of whom graduated and some of whom didn't, who were my peers, my colleagues, they didn't have the same experience at Latin School. And I was cognizant of that. And if anything else, BLS Black reminded me of some of those experiences and the work that Latin School has to do. But we didn't necessarily talk about it. So this is a unique opportunity for us to work with Latin, to talk about those issues, those experiences, and to come up with solutions, concrete solutions, to create a better environment. This Saturday, ironically, I'm meeting with a large group of alum of color who are coming back, some of whom are reconnecting with the school for the first time since they graduated in the 60s or 70s, to be a support for Latin School to do this work and to help them create a productive and healthy and safe environment, not just for kids of color, for every single kid, regardless of how they identify.
Right. So here's, I think, your personal story and what you just said really underscores the reason why there has been so much focus on Boston Latin School. I mean, I heard you say that it provided you a refuge. It transformed your life. Being there at that school has allowed you to become the person that you are. And that opportunity should be available, should be available for any student of color who wants to take the exam and pass the exam and get there.
Absolutely.
But we're seeing a school now that it's basically its ratio of students of color is virtually the opposite of the district as a whole, right? So I guess that's the reason why people have been focusing so much on Boston Latin, that it should look more like the rest of the district in order to say, you know, with pride, we're providing the same access to all Boston students who want to be able to come here.
Absolutely. And I would say we have work to do at the district level, not only in terms of increasing those numbers at Latin School, but at other schools that provide a quality education where we see more white students and we see less students of color. So we could go through a Rolodex of the 128 schools in the district and say, these schools that are classified as level one schools, how much of those of that student population are kids of color. And we'll probably see that they're predominantly white students. So that means that we need to have a larger conversation about why are students of color not gaining equal access to all of these schools. And I want to pull it out of the context of just Latin School and make it a larger conversation. I was at Latin, actually, when they started to reverse those set-asides, and that lawsuit was filed by a white student who did not gain entry to Latin. And I remember the tough conversations then about what that would mean for our school. And obviously it's played out in a certain way that we're not happy with. But we can't choose to just focus on Latin School when having those conversations. We need a concrete plan at the city level, at the district level, to make sure that every student who has access, who wants to attend Latin school, has equitable access. And that starts with looking at what access do they have to early ed, K-1, elementary school, middle school. Are we preparing them to take that exam? Are they reading at the third grade level? Are they doing math at the third grade level when they're in the third grade? So we have work to do that's bigger than simply looking at Latin school's numbers.
So, Counselor Campbell, then, I mean, are there any specific next steps that you'd like to see Superintendent Tommy Chang take, given the concerns and the vision that you just outlined?
I don't have all the answers. I'm not going to pretend I have all the answers, but it has to be more comprehensive. I was at a meeting not too long ago with Marie St. Flour, who's been advocating in her new role for additional early education and what that means for community and kids of color, creating new possibilities for giving students access to exam prep. So, for example, if kids have to take the exam to get into Latin, are there services and resources for the parents, for the students, for them to be fully prepared to take that exam? And so I look forward to sitting down with the superintendent. I talked to him yesterday. I look forward to sitting down with him and bringing some thoughts and ideas. I don't have all the answers, but I know it starts with acknowledging the problem, which is that we don't have a quality, and we cannot, for, if a parent is looking to enroll a student in a school, a quality school, they cannot identify a quality school from K-1 to the 12th grade. That's a problem. And so we have to make sure that the solutions we're generating are to address that problem.
Do you think that Superintendent Chang is the right person right now to help Boston Public Schools get further down that road?
I think so. I've been in contact with him. He's been responsive to me. He understands the seriousness of this. At the end of the day, he just got here, so we have to give him time to work. We have to give his team time to work and to grow in their positions at the end of the day. I'm relatively new as well to the city council. I'm only in my sixth month here, and we just can't pretend we know all the answers, but we have to be open-minded and invite all those who are passionate and committed to doing the work. We have to make sure they're invited to the table.
Andrea Campbell is a Boston City Councilor. Pleasure to speak with you, Councilor Campbell. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Peanuts, milk, eggs, types of foods that can trigger panic for many teachers, parents, and kids. Because today, an estimated 1 in 13 children in this country has a food allergy, a rate that's increased 50% since 1997. And no one seems to know why. The only treatment outside of a hospital emergency room is an EpiPen, which four moms were about to meet carry in bulk. These women have turned their frustration into fundraising and a plan for a new research effort at the Broad Institute in Cambridge that launches today. WBUR's Martha Biebinger has the story.
We'll start in a clinic at Boston Children's Hospital. Leslie Solomon, a mom from Brookline, was there with her 6-year-old son, who's allergic to milk. The boy's doctor thought he might be able to tolerate milk baked in, say, a muffin.
If you're going to have baked milk, it helps you grow out of your milk allergy.
Solomon agreed to try what's known in the world of food allergies as a food challenge.
Part of the way that they can tell you if you have an allergy is you have to eat the food.
There are tests that show whether a child is at risk for an allergic reaction. But to confirm an allergy and gauge the severity, you have to ingest some of the food that could kill you. So Solomon made muffins at home with milk, following a hospital recipe. She brought a muffin to the hospital and fed her son a tiny bite there in a clinic for this medical test.
And he failed it miserably. He went into anaphylaxis.
Solomon's son turned bright red. His throat closed up.
It was very emotional. It was very scary. We're on our way down to the emergency room after 2 EpiPens. He still couldn't breathe.
As Solomon's son recovered, she sat by his bedside, scouring the web, thinking there must be a better way to diagnose a food allergy. She vowed to find one and help bring it to market. That's Solomon's day job. She's director of the Innovation Hub at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Solomon tracked down the experts in food allergies, assuming they'd know what tools and treatments were in the pipeline. But she kept hearing the same thing.
There's just not enough basic science yet.
Here's what we know about food allergies from Aviv Regev, a biologist at MIT and the Broad Institute.
We know that for some reason our body senses the food, and for some reason it thinks that it is something horrible. And not only does it think it's something horrible, it thinks that the right response to it is to go completely berserk. We don't really know why.
In fact, says Regev, there are lots of why questions scientists have not answered about food allergies.
We don't know why certain substances and not others, and we especially don't know why some people but not others, and we don't really understand the full chain of events that leads to this chain reaction. If we did know, we might be able to stop it.
Last fall, Solomon connected with three other moms of young children, two who are doctors and an attorney for a Boston hedge fund. These women, who are well-connected in the world of medicine and finance in Boston, began gathering weekly and talking and emailing about a plan to stop the terror of food allergies.
Thank you.
Can I bring the coffee?
Thank you so much.
During breakfast meetings, these moms organized a symposium in Boston of top food allergy researchers. Experts in genetics, allergy and immunology, and the microbiome continued meeting. They eventually formed a core group of six scientists. The moms raised nearly $10 million through family members and the Richard and Susan Smith Family Foundation to launch the Food Allergy Science Initiative.
So the scientists met last week and are finalizing their research plan.
Dr. Christine Olson, a radiation oncologist at Mass General, updates her fellow moms at a Friday morning meeting.
But what they've developed so far is almost four pillars of research that they're going to look into.
Including which cells are involved in a food allergy response, how they react to different foods, how they relay messages, and why cells learn to tolerate foods when children outgrow an allergy. The scientists will also look at environmental and genetic factors. Eventually, they aim to find a better way to diagnose and treat food allergies. Right now, the guidance from many doctors is avoid any dangerous foods and carry an EpiPen at all times, which Olson says some parents are reluctant to use.
The EpiPen is scary, right? They have to take this needle and they have to jam it into their child's thigh and hold it there for 10 seconds while their child is having trouble breathing. I've done it before my child. It's a terrible thing to have to do.
The moms are hoping for some fast results. The scientists say it will take 3 to 5 years to understand food allergies at the cellular level. Dr. Wayne Schreffler, who heads the Food Allergy Center at Mass General, is one of the six scientists in this group.
The promise is really that by focusing on that fundamental level, we'll be in a position to discover some more transformative changes in therapy someday or in diagnosis.
There have been many ideas over the years about why there's a steady increase in the rate of food allergies. One theory suggests a food allergy is an inappropriate immune response. But that's not the view of Ruslan Mejitov, who will lead the Food Allergy Science Initiative. He sees a connection between food allergies and the body's defense mechanisms.
This is an exaggerated version of a normal defensive reaction that operates to screen food that we consume.
Mejitov says the body may be overreacting because foods these days are so carefully screened and preserved that the body can't always tell what's good and what's bad. The answer, he says, may be to return to more whole foods, although they may not be as pretty or as tasty.
I definitely try to avoid refined foods. It's just not part of general culture yet, but it's something that hopefully will become soon. I think the battle here would be with food industry primarily.
And all of us who look for the most beautiful fruit and the most brilliant white bread. But that's getting ahead of the story. For now, there's excitement that the field of food allergies, which has lagged behind so many other conditions, will get a needed boost. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says he expects good things from this initiative.
When you have something that jump starts in an area and brings in new people with resources and funding, that in and of itself creates an acceleration to the field that is needed at this point.
In the meantime, moms and dads, babysitters, and school nurses will keep arming themselves with EpiPens, hoping they'll get through today without needing to reach for one while calling 911 in a panic.
That report from WBUR's Martha Biebinger. All right, it's time for sports, which means Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, is here. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Magna.
Okay, so let's start with a piece of tape that's going to make you swoon, Mr. Buena Littlefield.
Messi! Messi with a record-breaking goal to the Argentina, number 55.
Number 55. Well, that was Lionel Messi scoring an instantly gif-able placed free kick in last night's USA-Argentina Copa America semifinals. Argentina crushed Team USA 4-0. Ah, but still, was last night's game as lopsided as the score suggests, Bill?
You want the short answer?
Let me guess.
Yes.
Yes, it was.
I think the possession in the first half was something utterly crazy, like 68% for Argentina.
Yeah.
And watching that game, there was a terrible sense that every time Argentina got the ball, they had an idea of what to do. They looked like they knew exactly what they wanted to do. And too often, when the U.S. would get the ball, they didn't seem to be able to do anything except kick it as far as they could and run after it and hope for the best.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it was a lopsided game.
Yeah, never a good strategy. But nevertheless, I mean, it's an accomplishment for Team USA to make it to the semifinals of the Copa America.
Well, it is. And Coach Klinsmann said before the tournament began, of course, he was pestered by people, you know, what would constitute an acceptable performance in this tournament. And he said, you know, well, it would be nice to get to the semifinals. And they got to the semifinals, and then, of course, he was pestered again, and he said there's no reason why the U.S. couldn't win the tournament, and it turned out there was a very good reason why the U.S. couldn't win the tournament, and it was the team from Argentina.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose if you're going to have a good reason, Argentina is a perfect
very good
one
reason.
Superb
reason.
To pick.
Yeah.
But I'm an endless Team USA optimist when it comes to soccer. I mean, the women, obviously, have given us lots of reasons many years now to be super optimistic.
Right.
The men seem to be climbing the ladder as well.
Yeah, if you're an optimist, you look at this tournament and you say, hey, they beat Ecuador, they beat Costa Rica, they beat Paraguay, they finished number one in their group. There's all kinds of reasons to feel very good about how they performed. And besides that, when they played against Argentina, they were missing several players who might have made a little bit of a difference. But I still think anybody watching that game with a sort of an honest point of view would say, gee whiz, the best team in the world is a lot better than the U.S. team.
Yeah, okay. Well, so let's talk about the best player on the best team in the world. I think Lionel Messi now is the highest scoring player in Argentinian history.
Yes, in international play with Argentina. He is a wonder. And because I'm a Barcelona fan, I also get to see him play when he's playing with Barcelona. And he is no less a wonder. As a matter of fact, I've talked to people from Argentina who are down on Lionel Messi because they say he plays so well for Barcelona and then Argentina never wins anything. And how come he can't do for Argentina what he's done in the past so often, because Barcelona has won so often what he's done for them. But they are looking as if perhaps on Sunday night they will win this tournament.
Yeah, maybe it's because Barcelona's paying him $9 billion.
Have you got the sheet in front of you with that figure? I'm not positive about those numbers.
That may be the one.
I'm sure it's close.
The one number that I cannot stand by as factual on Radio Boston. But okay, so let's move on.
It's okay. It's sports. It's okay exactly. To be a little bit careless.
Well, let's move on to other soccer news. This one a little closer to home. The Boston Globe reported today that Robert Kraft, of course, owner of the Patriots and the Revolution, is in talks with UMass Boston to buy land in Dorchester for a new soccer-only stadium. So would you like to see the Revs play not at Gillette?
Oh, I think anybody who's a soccer fan would like to see the Revs playing in their own stadium and a soccer-specific stadium, which, of course, has been required for teams coming into MLS for some time. But because the Revs were one of the original teams, they got grandfathered into the opportunity to play on a football field instead. There are all sorts of reasons why that's not a good idea. One of them is that even an acceptable crowd for a Revolution game looks like they forgot to tell people there was a game that day in Gillette because there's 68,756 seats there, and the Revs usually don't fill any more than about 15,000 to 18,000.
There's a lot of tarp covering.
Yeah,
the
there's
other
a lot
seats,
of tarp
yeah.
covering, and it's a bad setting. And it go to an MLS game in one of the cities that has a soccer specific stadium, and you'll instantly see the difference. It looks like they're playing in the right place. And some of these stadiums are very smart. They've built them so that they're modular. They look right when there are 20,000 people attending the game, and the stadium can be expanded for when the game gets more popular in that particular city. So it's certainly possible to do that.
I'm also wondering, Bill, like, you know, getting to Foxborough, depending on your situation, is either easy or not so easy. So bringing a soccer stadium, you know, into closer to the center of Greater Boston might be great for all the soccer fans who couldn't get out to Foxborough.
Yeah, I think it'll be great for people who, as long as this is someplace that is as accessible as it seems like it's going to be via public transportation, it should make a lot of sense. Unhappily, there have been lots of busted plans to build such a stadium in all kinds of different places. So I hope this one will go forward.
Okay, so we start our conversation talking about sporting greatness with Lionel Messi. Let's talk about another demonstration of sporting greatness that was a little earlier this week. Let's talk basketball.
One dribble, steps back, puts up a three. Won't go. Rebound tip taken by Spades. Final seconds. It's over. It's over. Cleveland is a city of champions once again. The Cavaliers are NBA champions.
First of all, did you ever expect to hear the words Cleveland is a city of champions once again?
I'm delighted for people in Cleveland. What fun.
It's fantastic.
It's great fun. And, of course, it's a great subplot that LeBron James returned to the Cavaliers, having been declared a traitor and much worse by people in that area when he left and took his talents to South Beach.
He is the prodigal son, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And never has a prodigal son been so lavishly compensated. Kill the fatted calf. Forget the fatted calf. How about millions and millions of dollars for the fellow?
But he brings home victory.
He
I mean,
did.
In a great seven-game series, too.
Yeah, a seven-game series is always the best because you get more stories. Yeah. And you get more interpersonal relations. You get more kind of people getting mad at each other and making faces at each other and the whole rest of it. So, it was a great series. Team coming back from down 3-1. LeBron against Stephen Curry. The whole thing made for a marvelous drama throughout the postseason.
Yeah, but as you said, I think the big winner here is Cleveland.
No doubt.
The first major sports championship won by a Cleveland team since 1964.
The parade is probably still going on.
And it should.
Yeah.
Well done, Cleveland. Well, Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs on Saturdays on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., and he joins us here for some sports talk on Radio Boston on Wednesdays. Bill, always great to have you.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Mr. Speaker, I would ask that all of my colleagues join me on the floor.
Well, that is how Georgia Democratic Congressman John Lewis began what's turned into a dramatic protest action on the House floor this afternoon. The House has no filibuster, so more than 40 Democrats are staging a sit-in to demand a vote on several gun control proposals.
We have turned deaf ears to the blood of the innocent and the concern of our nation. We are blind to a crisis. Mr. Speaker, where is the heart of this body? Where is our soul? Where is our moral leadership? Where is our courage?
Well, in the past hours, many members of the Massachusetts delegation also joined Congressman Lewis in the sit-in. So joining us from Washington is Kimberly Atkins. She's chief Washington reporter for the Boston Herald. Kimberly, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you.
Great to talk to you with you too. First of all, tell us a little bit about what's going on in the House now, and sort of what the feeling and the tone is surrounding this sit-in. What's the reaction in Congress?
Yeah, it was really quite remarkable. I mean, right now you have several dozen members, Democrats from the House and also members of the Senate who have gone to the House floor to join this sit-in that Representative Lewis started just around noontime today. So it's been going on for, you know, we're coming up on 4 hours now in the House. And it was really interesting. I mean, actually, when this all happened, I was in Congressman Moulton's office just for a pre-scheduled, unrelated interview that I and some of my colleagues were doing. And at that time, as we were leaving and heading toward Congressman Capuano's office, we were told that Congressman Capuano was actually on the floor. He was actually one of the first folks engaging in this sit-in, and that soon after, Congressman Moulton went down as well. And just in the halls of Congress, people, you know, word was spreading. People were texting and figuring out what was going on as members, some members headed down to the floor to join this sit-in. It was really interesting because after it was gaveled, after the House was gaveled into recess when the members refused to leave the floor, C-SPAN coverage, the cameras were shut off, so people in their offices couldn't actually see what was happening. And so it became this social media flurry very quickly spreading.
Exactly, because we've been seeing the tweets the live feeds of over Periscope and other apps like that. So let me ask you a little bit. We've seen you know, through these other live feeds that Senator Elizabeth Warren, Representative Joe Kennedy, Senator Ed Markey, Catherine Clark, Representative Catherine Clark, Representative Jim McGovern, many members of the Massachusetts delegation are there or have been there in the past hour, in part because John Lewis, being the driver behind the sit-in, brings a great deal of moral authority to it. I mean, he's a civil rights icon who sat in at lunch counters in the height of the civil rights movement, at Democratic conventions, you know, walked across bridges, putting his own life on the line. So I want to listen to a little bit more about what Congressman Lewis said about why he's taking this action in the House today.
We must remove the blinders. The time for silence and patience is long gone. We're calling on the leadership of the House to bring common sense gun control legislation to the House floor. Give us a vote. Let us vote. We came here to do our job. We came here to work.
Kimberly, though, on the other hand, I'm seeing a statement from House Speaker Paul Ryan's office saying that for as long as there's this disruption in the House, they're not reluctant to gavel back in. So, you know, how long could this last? Is there any chance that it could go on for some time?
It looks that way. I mean, this one thing about this is it's unprecedented. I mean, the folks in the House offices that I was talking to said, you know, I was trying to get that same sense. Well, how long is this going to go on? Is this going to break? And because it really, these things don't happen very often, no one really knew. It looks like it could be for a while if there's no vow, I think, to put the no-buy, no-fly legislation to a vote. I mean, I could see John Lewis sitting there for a very long time, and there are lots of people now surrounding him, as you said, now Congresswoman right. Clark and Senator Warren and others. I could see this going on for quite some time.
Well, in the last couple seconds that we have, in the event that this action, I mean, we don't know, but in the event if it does push the House to actually, or Republican leadership to decide to call for a vote, I mean, is there any hope that these gun control legislative measures would pass in the House? I mean, they certainly did not pass in the Senate.
They did not pass in the Senate. You know, now we will see possible vote in the Senate on the compromise measure that was put forth by Senator Susan Collins of Maine. But you know, it remains to be seen if this does have a chance. I mean, it's really tough. There's been a lot of opposition to this no-fly list legislation from people who say there's so many people on this list erroneously and they don't want to take away their gun control rights. So I think it's going to be a really tough call. How close it is in the House, if the Senate is any guide, it's going to be a really tough road.
Well, Kimberly Atkins is the chief Washington, D.C. reporter for the Boston Herald. Kimberly, great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, finally today, we're going to talk about the imminent nursing strike at Brigham and Women's Hospital. The Massachusetts Nurses Association says its members will stage a one-day strike next Monday if the hospital and the union cannot come to an agreement on a new contract. It would be the first strike in 30 years by nurses in a Boston hospital. And if the strike takes place, the hospital says it already has contracted with an outside agency to supply about 700 replacement nurses for 5 days, meaning the hospital would be locking out the striking nurses for 4 additional days to ensure continuity of care. Well, we're going to hear from both sides of this issue about what they're thinking now, and we're going to begin with the nurses' union. Jim McCarthy is a nurse in the recovery unit at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's also a member of the nurses' union bargaining committee, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Megan. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So it seems as if the nurses' union is basically asking for three main things regarding wages, benefits, and staffing at Brigham and Women's Hospital. So let's just dive into the wages question.
Sure.
Because it seems as if the Brigham and Women's already has a step-up feature of roughly 5% per year for nurses, or nurses at the top of the pay scale. And
well, if I can interject.
Yeah, please.
Well, basically what that is that the STEP program has been set with, through the contract, and that was decided and negotiated eons ago.
Yeah.
When the contracts were first done. Basically, it's STEP program. So each year a nurse is at the hospital on their anniversary, they increase by steps up to 18 years. So each year there'll be a 5% increase and for those nurses itself. But then at the 18th year, then that stops basically. So I know, for example, I have someone who I work with closely in the recovery unit myself, and she's been there for 29 years. So for 11 years, she hasn't gotten any increase at all.
It
plateaus after 18 years.
And so
correct.
what is the union then asking for?
Well, we're asking for basically a fair increase across the board. For it's actually less than the cost of living increase itself for all the nurses. And then we would like to get a top step. So we'd like to get a 19 step for those nurses who haven't really got anything for a number of years.
Okay, and why isn't? But I guess beyond the plateau question, why isn't the rest of the STEP plan? I mean, adequate? Because I was looking at the fact that last year the hospital announced that all non-unionized staff were going to get an average 2% raise.
Correct. Right. That's what we're talking about.
But I thought the nurses were contracted for 5% every year.
Well, not every year, only up to the 18 years itself. So at that point, like I said, most of us will get an increase, on our anniversary itself. But again, once you hit that 18th year, that increase stops.
Okay.
But again, on top of that, you also have, we are looking for, even for those people who, like myself, I'm still in that STEP system myself. I've only been with the hospital for 11 years. And we're looking for an increase for those people as well, too, because the cost of living has gone up as well. And in addition to that, you have health insurance going up, as well as parking at the hospital and other rudimentary costs that affect everyone every day.
Well, let me ask you, though. I mean, so Brigham and Women's Hospital is one of the premier and largest hospitals in Massachusetts. It had a revenue of $3.3 billion in fiscal year 2015, but it also actually, at the end of last year, faced a $53 million shortfall for a bunch of different reasons. But I was looking at the numbers from last year, and hospital administration said that costs overall for the hospital were rising at about 3 to 4%, but revenues were only rising at 1%. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess the question is, what do you make of the argument that the hospital can't pay for what the nurses' union is asking for?
I think that's a facetious argument, because if you look at just the last quarter, they made $150 million in revenue itself for the hospital itself. And what we're asking, this is a nonprofit hospital, and in addition to that, you're controlled by Partners, which is a billion-dollar corporation. And what we're asking for is take those profits that you're making and put it back into the infrastructure itself, put it back into the hospital, and the nurses are part of the hospital. Again, this is a nonprofit corporation nonprofit hospital. We feel that, for those revenues, they should be put back into it. We're not saying that if it was hard times and the hospital wasn't making the money they should be, then we would totally understand that. But at this time, the profits are there, and we feel that that's justifiable.
So talk to me briefly about what the nurses' union is looking for regarding staffing, because that seems to be another major sticking point.
It's a huge issue. Right now, we have 3,300 nurses, and patient safety is our top priority, top concern. And in regard to that, right now, We have something called an unsafe staffing form. So when we have situations where a floor is not properly staffed, you have high critical patients that you're taking care of and they can't be cared for correctly, we pass off unsafe staffing forms to the management saying, look, this is an issue, this is a problem. They have stack and stacks of those each month that are sent off to the management. In addition to that, we have issues with staffing on various floors. We have the sickest of the sickest patients in this area. I mean, we're a top hospital, and again, we get the patients that other hospitals can't take. And surgical patients, for instance, our thoracic unit, it's one of the best in the country and the world. And again, we're taking care of patients that other hospitals couldn't take care of.
So you're saying the staffing ratios should be different? Or?
Well, no. What we're asking for is to basically go back to the staffing ratios we had previously. If you see after like 2009, 2010, staffing ratios seem to be have changed, and we're also looking at the fact that with issues, for instance, let me get back to the thoracic unit. Thoracic unit is a very specialized unit. We take care of thoracic patients, people suffering from mesothelioma, cancer. It's a very highly specialized area, and to care for these patients, you have to have special skills, which it takes a lot of training and everything else. I was actually on that unit myself. I can speak of experience from that, and the training needed for that is it's cumbersome, but it's basically something that we do and we're passionate about as well. So
I'm seeing here a statement from the Massachusetts Hospital Association from a little earlier this month, and they say they do not comment on particular labor disputes, but in the statement they also added that, quote, there is no way that predetermined formulistic nurse staffing plans can achieve the best patient-focused care, and that such a singular focus actually runs counter to the collaborative, innovative, and integrated care models that provide the best patient care.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we're asking for is basically we're asking with the nurses, we're in the front lines. We're there. We're able to say, this is what we need to care for these patients. They can come up with all the rules and formulas they want to look at. But for us ourselves, we can say, look, we know we're there. We're in the trenches. We're not up in an office, looking down and looking at numbers. There is an axiom that is known for nursing school that we've always ingrained in all of us. Basically, you want to look at the patient, not the numbers. Unfortunately, it seems with Partners Corporation, they want to look at basically the numbers, not the patient itself. Okay. So, and that's, like I said, that's the problem. We're there, we're on the front lines, we see these patients, and we know what we need to do to care for them properly.
Well, another set of numbers I'm seeing is that the average registered nurse at Brigham and Women's Hospital currently makes $106,000 a year, whereas the average in the rest of Massachusetts is roughly $89,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could dig into the numbers forever, but I just have one last question for you. So if this dispute continues on until next Monday, the nurses' union has planned a one-day walkout, and as we mentioned, it could end up being a total of 5 days that other nurses would have to be brought in.
Yeah.
The union certainly must have some concerns about the impact on patient care that the strike could have.
Of course. No, it would be devastating for the hospital. You can't have people coming in who don't know anything about the hospital, who don't know our patient population, people who are coming in who we call them mercenary nurses. They're basically coming in, they're hired guns, coming in, basically all they're there for is profit. We're there because we're passionate. We want to be there for our patients. We want to be making sure we're taking care of our patients correctly. These people are coming in, and all they're there for is solely for the money. We're only asking for a one-day strike. The hospital is locking us out for 5 days. We want to return to work after that one-day strike. The hospital is not going to let us. Again, we are, like I said, we're willing to strike, but we're also willing to go back and continue in negotiations. We still have a few more days left. We're still waiting to hear back from the hospital. The hospital walked out on Monday.
Met 20 times already.
21 times.
21 times.
I've been at every one of these ones. Believe me, not the higher executives. They haven't been there. Dr. Ron Walls and Betsy Nabel have not been there at all. I've been there every single time. I know what's going on with those negotiations. I can tell you, it's tiring, and also the last few ones have been very contentious. But the last meeting we had, the hospital walked out. At that point, we're waiting to hear back to say, we're willing to go back to the table. But again.
Well, Jim McCarthy is a nurse in the recovery unit at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's also a member of the union's bargaining committee. Thank you very much,
You're
Jim.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks, Megan.
All right. Well, Jim mentioned Dr. Walls. That's Dr. Ron Walls. He's the executive vice president and chief operating officer at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he joins us now on the line. Dr. Walls, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us today. First of all, I actually just want to ask you quickly to respond to a quote that we saw in the Boston Globe a little earlier, that the fact that the conversation or the negotiation has reached such an impasse that a strike could be imminent. It's pretty disturbing because we haven't had one in Boston in 30 years. And Gary Chason, he's the professor of industrial relations at Clark University. He says it's very rare for healthcare workers to go on strike. They only go on strike if they feel tremendously neglected. It's a call for help. And I wonder what Brigham and Women's response is to that.
Well, we started this negotiation in October. And as you mentioned, we've had more than 20 full day sessions now. We certainly don't want a strike, have never wanted a strike. And we've worked systematically through the negotiations with the union to be sure that we are putting fair and equitable packages on the table that we think are good for all of our nurses. Look, we really value our nurses. We pay our nurses, I think you pointed this out earlier, at the highest possible pay scale. And we are proud of our nursing staff. And I'm an emergency physician. I worked very closely with them side by side. But the reality is that in order to negotiate to a settlement and an agreement, both sides have to really negotiate. And contrary to what Jim mentioned earlier, on last Friday night when we had negotiated all day, we offered to stay all night and also to negotiate on Saturday, and the union didn't wish to do that. We've made it clear to the mediator that we want to get back to the table. And in fact, the mediator has asked us back to the table on Friday, and we've accepted. We're looking forward to that. And we want to do everything we can to avert a strike, but at the same time, we have to be ready for a strike.
So, Dr. Wells, let me ask you, very frequently in these kinds of labor disputes, there's a question of a sense of value and differences between administration and the labor and in that value. And I think Jim was getting to that perhaps a little bit when he pointed out that the hospital's most senior, most veteran nurses who've been there, you know, for 18 years face a plateau in their salaries, and maybe the hospital is communicating that those people who are most veteran aren't valued as much as they could or should be. Your response to that?
Yes, our senior nurses are among our most valued nurses because they're the most experienced, and we've worked with them for a long time. They know everything so well. It's not true to say, though, that once people get off the steps, they have no further increases, because the union has negotiated additional steps and further increases for those people who had cleared that 5% step bracket. And over the last 10 years, that group of people has actually had 26% increase in their income through negotiated contracts. So to say they haven't had an increase for the last 10 or 11 years is just not true.
Hmm. Well, what about this question of staffing? Because Brigham and Women's Hospital has stated that the staffing in its step-down units is comparable or better than the industry standard. But a 2014 bit of research from Boston College that we looked at found that the average number of patients cared by registered nurses on the step-down units at Brigham and Women's was higher than at Beth Israel, UMass Medical Center, Metro West Medical Center, et cetera.
Well, we absolutely disagree that staffing is an issue, that we have any problem with staffing ratios or proper coverage. And we would be happy to have our staffing levels compared against any applicable benchmarks. In fact, they do get compared to those benchmarks. The reason you get differences between organizations is that step-down patients are defined differently in different organizations. So it depends on what the definition of the patient is. And also, I think Jim said it very well, it's important to consider the patient, him or herself, and what kind of patient is it really. And we're very proud of our staffing levels, and we would happily compare them to any other hospital like ours.
Hmm. And what about Jim's assertion that the hospital can afford financially to meet the demands of the nurses' union?
Well, we're a not-for-profit, so all of the margin, you call it sort of profit, you'd call it, that we make in partners, both at the Brigham and Mass General, go back in to fund our research, our buildings. We're building a research building here. We're looking to build a new patient care area at Mass General. So all of the profits of the organization are reinvested. And in addition, when we make a margin here at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and we certainly didn't make remotely near $150 million in the last quarter, I don't know where that came from, but when we make a margin here, most of our margin and Mass General's margin, it's all combined into partners, and almost half of it goes out to fund the parts of our system that can't fund themselves. Mental health, North Shore Medical Center, loses tens of millions of dollars every year, and we inject money into that center to keep it going, to keep the nurses there, the doctors there, to keep the care there. So the partner system reinvests all of its profits, some of them into the system itself to keep it operating, those parts that don't operate well on their own, and the rest of it into research and buildings for patient care and so forth. There is no profit.
Dr. Walls, we just have a few seconds to go, and based on what I've heard from both of you gentlemen today, it sounds like a strike is fairly imminent. Do you have any reason for optimism?
We're happy to go back to the negotiating table on Friday. We have never wanted a strike, but we have to get to a point where both we and the union understand that with all of the pressure we have on us in healthcare now to be fiscally responsible, we have to act together in a fiscally responsible way and create a framework that works.
Ron Walls is the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Walls, thank you very much.
And thank you so much.
We heard a little earlier from Jim McCarthy. He spoke on behalf of the Brigham and Women's Hospital Nursing Union as well. We'll keep following the story as it develops. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's it for today. This is Radio Boston.